We start this afternoon with education. Education is essential for full participation, and it is a complex area in which the law is also moderately complex. We have two people to present. Mark Weber is Vincent DePaul Professor of Law at DePaul University College of Law. He is the author of Disability Harassment, Understanding Disability Law, and Special Education Law and Litigation. He is the co-author of Special Education Law, Cases and Materials. Professor Weber frequently speaks on disability law issues at national and international programs and is active in community service and legislative initiatives on disability matters. We also have Leslie Margolis, who has been a managing attorney at the Maryland Disability Law Center since 1985. As an expert in special education and representation of abused and neglected foster children with disabilities, she has individual and systemic litigation expertise. She frequently trains parents and professionals and is a member of numerous boards and committees, including the Epilepsy Foundation of America and the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates. And she reminded me that she has worked with our National Organization of Parents of Blind Children for a number of years. To begin, here is Professor Weber.
Well, thanks very much for having me. Thanks to Dr. Maurer and to Lou Ann Blake and the other organizers of the conference. One of the things that's particularly encouraging, I think, is to have education play a role in the discussions about disability law and disability rights, because if people don't have the education they need, it's hard to take your place in society. It's hard to be someone who is able to have an active role in society. And I think as we've seen the economy evolve over the years, it does seem there are fewer and fewer positions for people who do not have educational achievements, educational credentials, the sorts of things that education provide. What Leslie and I have conspired more or less to talk about is a bit on what we perceive as the upcoming future, to be expected, I guess, issues in education law with respect to kids with disabilities. In light of the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that is coming up, as well as the reauthorization of things like the No Child Left Behind Act that's really upon us at the moment, the informal working title that I've had for the talk, though, is a little bit pithier and maybe a little more direct. It's issues of quality and equality. So both of those considerations, both better, more intense, more effective services, and services that will enable kids to be equal, to really take a role of full inclusion in the society as they grow into adulthood. What we'd like to do is kind of recognize the fact that special education law has been, believe it or not, I think, quite successful as far as social initiatives go, and recognize that. We always complain about special education law because we see it in action, and we know things that are wrong about it. But in fact, it has achieved remarkable things for a whole lot of kids. That being said, of course, the fact is that there are a lot of remaining problems as well, and we'll try to address some of those. In particular, what I'll be talking about are lingering and I think quite pervasive concerns having to do with kids' entitlement to services, what for those of us in the trade works out as being the topic of eligibility or qualification under IDEA. And I also want to address what I view as the plain and simple issue of achievement, quality of services, and making sure that kids with disabilities actually are able to hold their own in integrated classrooms. Leslie will be focusing on least restrictive environment issues, including not only that topic in itself, but also matters such as exit exams and disciplinary topics as well. Let me return just for a second to why it is that I'm at least guardedly happy applauding the achievements of special education law. The fact is, you know, in 1975, which at least some of us can still remember that year, you know, we're around then, you did have 1.75 million kids out of school, period, simply because they had disabilities. You had of roughly 8 million kids who were thought to have had disabilities at that time, no more than 4 million who were getting services that could be described as anything like adequate. And a whole lot of kids were excluded, you know, sometimes because the parents were simply told there was no program. But often they would go to school and last a few years and then get expelled for being unmanageable or not in some way complying. And after that, there was nothing. Parents banded together for self-help. Some of the organizations that a number of us have worked with that are now community rehabilitation organizations started out as schools for kids who are excluded from the public schools. That is a phenomenon that doesn't happen now. And I think we do need to recognize that, however much we may complain about what happens in its stead. But of course, the fact is that as you do make achievements at getting kids into school and doing better with them, and you know, we are doing better. The dropout rate, for example, has declined by 17 percentage points in the last 10 years or so, last 20 years or so. The fact is that expectations tend to go up, you know, and what it is you need goes up. The other thing that I think is happening and that both Leslie and I recognize, and I think most advocates in the special ed arena recognize as well, is that there is some backsliding, some slippage going on. I perceive it very directly in the topic of eligibility, where school districts are trying everything they can to keep kids from being designated as being special education eligible kids, which, you know, they're saying, well, of course, we don't want to stigmatize kids, we don't want to label them, and it sounds great, but the fact is that that means that then there's no enforceable entitlement to appropriate services, and I think that's a serious problem. So let me then address directly this topic of eligibility and quality of services. You'll notice that among the things that Leslie and I have not chosen to address are some of the more obvious things, maybe, like procedural rights. Those might very well come up in reauthorization, but Leslie and I think determined we didn't have too much unique or new to say about them, or even talk about trying to make a frontal assault on the main case on appropriate education, which is the Rowley case. I don't think that's a winning strategy. I think I'd prefer to focus on things that are more achievable. And I think eligibility is an issue that either by legislative or I think maybe more plausibly by litigation, we might be able not only to stop what I think is some quite improper action by school districts, but also maybe to make some strides. What's happening with regard to that topic? Well, the first thing that people are, of course, aware of, but that maybe needs to be highlighted a bit, is that learning disabilities as a topic has come under the full bore of would-be reformers, and they've got a point. You know, the number of kids designated as having learning disabilities increased 283% from 1976 to 1996. Now, that's partly because mild mental retardation or educable mental retardation disappeared as a category during that time period, and people wanted to shove kids in somewhere else. But it's still rather alarming. There are also, of course, serious doubts about the usefulness of IQ testing and the fact that kids' scores tend to vary dramatically. And there also are dramatic variations in the percentage of kids designated as LD in one state to the next, all of which gave rise to a lot of pretty well justified skepticism about how it is we determine who has LD and is designated for that. What's been the solution? Well, we can see the special ed folks light up here perhaps. RTI, does that term ring a bell? It's response to intervention, which is the new buzzword, came out into prominence in about 2002, 2003, was enshrined in a fair amount of the legislative history and some of the regulatory history of the 2004 amendments to IDEA. The idea is kind of simple. If you've got a kid who is struggling in learning, what you do is you subject that child to ever more intensive intervention. So either smaller group or more hours or just different kinds of educational methods. If the child responds to that, you say, great. And then you either try to maintain those things or you reintegrate the kid into whatever else the rest of the class is doing, and you just watch and see that that works out okay. If that doesn't work, you try another tier or level of intervention. If that doesn't work, you try yet another one, and it keeps on going on and on. Oddly enough, if the kid then at the end is, I don't know what the word is, incorrigible, unsomethingable, then the kid is finally designated as being LD. And I don't know what you do at that point. You know, there's no clear answer. But the idea is that that will in some way avoid the problem of the instructional casualty, the kid who just is not taught well and simply doesn't respond because of that. And there is, I think, some logic to that. The drawbacks to it, which I think are quite serious and have not fully been recognized, are that first, nobody really has much in the way of good data to show that it works for much of anything except reading decoding, that is not even reading comprehension, and for kids who are above, say, about second grade. Now, people are collecting data right and left on this, and it could be that other more useful studies will come out. But at the moment, if all that we're going to have to determine learning disability is this method, it's really quite unproven, and it's quite unclear how it's going to work when it's implemented at scale. And I know in Illinois, where I'm from, it's being implemented at great scale. And the effect is that a lot fewer kids are being designated, for better or for worse. If they're getting good instruction out of it, more power to them. The concern I have is, yeah, but if you don't get designated as having the learning disability, you don't have the legal entitlement to appropriate education. If you don't have that, the parents don't get notice or any of the other things that enable parents to assert rights. And crucially, if you don't have that designation, you don't get the discipline protections that IDEA provides. And those, I think, are quite serious concerns, to the point where I think that parents often would be wise to demand evaluations even in the course of RTI, or we should be perhaps thinking of strategies to litigate for more effective determination of eligibility when RTI is being used. So that's one cluster of things dealing with eligibility. Let me mention a couple of others. Another one that's quite prominent and of great concern to a lot of folks is the fact that there are serious racial disparities with respect to identification with regard to disability. The statistics that the Department of Education has indicate that there is a 3 times more likely chance that a child who is African American will be designated as having mental retardation than a child of any other ethnic group or of all other ethnic groups combined. The ratio is 2.3 for emotional disturbance. There are some ethnic disparities as well with respect to Latino kids, although they're much more scattered and seem to be located in some specific geographic areas. But that's a matter of real concern. Not only does it mean that there is this greatly disproportional identification, but also those kids then kids who are in mental retardation, and particularly African-American kids who are designated as MR, wind up being in separated or segregated settings to a much greater degree than other kids, even with disabilities. And once you're in that system, it's hard for the expectations ever to move up to put you at the point where people will think that, well, this kid ought to be at grade level. No, of course he shouldn't be at grade level. He's in a mental retardation classroom. Those kinds of attitudes are particularly difficult to overcome. There is no, I think, particularly easy or simple solution to this one, in my opinion. There's a blunt case going on currently in Pennsylvania, which most recently has been unsuccessful, trying to challenge the over-designation. Whether that will, in some instance, become more successful, I do not know, but I've not seen litigation strategies work out terribly well in this situation. My good friend, Rob Garda, who teaches at Loyola New Orleans, actually proposes that we should revise the definition of eligibility for special education to make it more difficult for kids to be considered eligible, and he thinks that'll have a benefit with regard to the racial disproportions here. I'm skeptical about it. I think that there are some kind of countervailing concerns. The fact is, of course, if somebody is having difficulty in regular education programming, I'd prefer to see the kid get services, and I'd prefer to see the kid have an entitlement to services. I think that particularly African-American kids, who evidence seems to show are disproportionately singled out for school discipline, are particularly in need of things like the procedural protections found in IDEA. On the other hand, I do think that the segregation or separation of kids with the designation really is what's unconscionable. That's where the attention ought to be drawn to, the separation rather than the designation itself. But I think it is a serious problem, and if it were able to be addressed in reauthorization, I would be the first in line to support that. Let me mention a third problem with respect to identification and then turn to quality of services. The third thing that I just want to mention, I don't know if this is a problem or if it's an opportunity or what's the line from Emmanuel, don't ever let a crisis go to waste or something. It's maybe both of those, but as you all know, the Amendments Act for the ADA went into effect January 1st of 2009. It, of course, does dramatically expand the protections of Section 504 and the ADA, not only to include impairments that are mitigated, but also to include those that are episodic or in remission, but would be a disability if they were active. Also includes, and this I think is critical and has not paid enough attention to, includes major bodily functions, you know, the endocrine system and the immune system and the respiratory system and the circulatory system, all as major life activities. So if you've got any child with an impairment of those things and it can be deemed as something that has a significant impact on these functions, the kid is eligible under Section 504 and under the ADA. Not quote Joe Biden, that's a big deal. It means a lot of kids are covered. So what does that mean? Well, all of us who spent all that time digging through IDEA, we got to start digging through Section 504 and trying to assert the rights of the kids who are, quote, Section 504 eligible. Those of us who have tried to deal with that situation at all know that there are a lot of schools that do create 504 plans, as they call them. It usually means a little bit of extra time on tests, maybe preferential seating in the classroom, maybe one or two other things. The limits of that envelope, I think, need to be pushed. There is stuff in the regulations that is pushable. The regulations provide that the child is entitled to free appropriate public education under Section 504. One way of meeting that is under IDEA. Now, mostly that's been used by courts to say, ah, he failed under his IDEA claim. Of course, he's got to lose under his Section 504 claim. But in fact, we have to try to push the limits of what free appropriate public education means there too. What's more, the regulations also provide for procedural rights, although they're maddeningly, or perhaps happily, vague on that issue. That's another issue which we can push. Finally, you know, one of the original cases on discipline for kids with disabilities is the S1 v. Turlington case way back in the 1980s. That was litigated under both the special ed law and under Section 504, and it said under Section 504, you've got a right not to be excluded because of conduct that's a manifestation of your disability. That's huge, and you know, it's not even limited by the stuff that came in 97 and 04 in the IDEA. So I think, again, that issue needs to be pushed. Well, I've gone on and on about eligibility. Let me mention a word or two about what I perceive as the quality or the lag in achievement kinds of issues. I mentioned that I think that special ed law has been a success and quite a major one, but there's a whole lot that needs to be done. Then there are statistics that go right and left on this. The kids who do best in special ed appear to be kids who simply or merely have either visual or hearing impairments. But even of those kids, you know, 70% of kids with visual impairments are at or above grade level. That means 30% are not. 83% of kids with hearing impairments are at or above. So 17% are not. And it tails down rapidly for other categories of disability after that. In reading and in math, about 1 in 8 special ed designated kids are at grade level in both subjects. They average about 3.5, actually it's 3.6 years behind grade level. There's double the rate of grade retention for kids with disabilities. A report came out quite recently, there's a much higher rate of corporal punishment for kids with disabilities than other kids. The point that I'm trying to emphasize here is that, you know, except perhaps for a very small number of kids who have very, very severe intellectual disabilities, there is no reason that kids should not be at grade level. Ideally, they should be doing as well as everybody else's, but they ought to be at grade level. And if the child simply has a learning disability, simply has a visual impairment, the kid ought to be at grade level. And that's the bottom line in my humble view. What's the solution to try to deal with that? Well, you could mount a frontal attack on that Rowley case, you know, that all you get is your foot in the door of education. Didn't work before. We haven't gotten it yet. I'm pessimistic on that one. Are there other possible solutions? Yeah, I think maybe. Let me just mention a couple, and you can consider them or not as you may be. One of them, and this is almost a retrenchment kind of an issue rather than a one in which maybe we can act aggressively. You know, NCLB, as I mentioned, is up for reauthorization, and there is some movement afoot either to try to exclude kids with disabilities from the counting of whether the school's making progress, or at least to in some way change the evaluation method so that those kids will be evaluated only under their IEP rather than for grade level. I think that's a terrible idea. I'm not a fan of testing. As Alfie Cohn points out, if you want to predict a kid's test scores, the best thing to do is look at the size of the kid's house. Yeah, in fact, wealth is the primary determinant. But the fact is, kids should be reading, kids should be doing math at grade level. And if testing is the only way to do that, then it's got to be done, in my view. And you've got to have some real sanctions to schools and school districts that don't have special ed kids achieving at grade level. In fact, there are statistics indicating that there's been some achievement success during the period of NCLB for kids with disabilities. Second, and this now moves into litigation strategies as opposed to dealing with NCLB. Uh-oh, am I out of time?
Pretty quick.
Okay, I'll talk really, really fast. Two strategies we might want to think about would be trying to deal with the peer-reviewed research part of the IDEA statute and regulations. Had a checkered history so far, but there's a case called Waukee Community that's worth looking into. And finally, perhaps dealing with least restrictive environment, particularly the part of it that says you're entitled to services to achieve in the mainstream as a method of actually getting quality and intensity of services. So thank you all, and I'll turn it over to Leslie.
Thank you. I also want to thank the organizers of this conference and Lou Ann Blake for answering all my questions as we were doing the planning. I didn't come up with a title for my talk, but I guess given what Mark said about how things are better, I would say the title of my talk would be, Yes, They're Better, But. I'm going to start by telling you about two students, Cindy and Samuel, not their real names. Cindy is a very hardworking, eager to learn 10th grade student with a very wicked sense of humor. She happens to have cerebral palsy, a vision impairment, and learning disabilities. She spent her preschool year at her neighborhood school, which after that year said, oh my God, you can't stay here. You are way too disabled to be in a regular education school. And they pushed her to her school for the blind, where she suddenly had a very functional life skills curriculum, not an academic one, and in fact didn't have a teacher because there was no teacher in her class, so she was in, two classes were combined and they had an aide teaching. And her parents were really unhappy with that situation, surprise. And so over the course of the next year, she was transitioned back to her neighborhood school, which was not so happy to see her come back, but to their credit, worked to have her included. And ever since first grade, she has been fully included quite successfully. She is working below grade level, but is on track to get a diploma. She gets many accommodations. She takes modified assessments under the No Child Left Behind assessments. She will take modified end of course assessments, which are the exit exams in our state. And she receives a lot of accommodations and supports, including a lot of assistive technology, reduced workload, peer tutors, a one-to-one aide, all of which have made her education very successful. Not to say that there haven't been bumps in the road, but she is doing well. She is on track, hopefully, to get a diploma. She has immeasurably enriched the lives of her school community. She is well-liked by her peers, by her teachers, and her life has been immeasurably enriched by her inclusion. At the time that I represented him, Samuel was 12 years old. He has autism. He does not have enough language to be able to express how he feels. So he expresses how he feels by engaging in some pretty difficult behaviors. He was placed in a functional life skills class in a regular elementary school. He had a lot of behavior outbursts at school, which resulted in frequent use of restraint and placement in what the school euphemistically called its support room, where he was supposed to stand with his hands against a wall to calm down and then be returned to his class. Often he was restrained for several times during the same day. Often he sustained bruises and scratches as a result of the restraints. When his behavior escalated, he began to be suspended for the behavior, which was clearly a result of his disability. And then when they didn't know what to do, the school began to put him on a half-day schedule. The team was well-intentioned. Teachers and the school staff cared about him. They attempted to develop a behavior intervention plan. They just simply had no idea what to do with him and no idea how to address his behavior. Ultimately, Samuel was recommended for a private placement at public expense. In the interim, he moved to another public school, a separate public school for children with disabilities, where the staff actually were able to meet his behavioral needs, and he has been successfully maintained there. I tell you these stories because what we know is the IDEA, which was enacted 35 years ago, has made a huge difference for students. I think Cindy tells us how far we've come and in many ways exemplifies the fulfillment of that statute. Samuel tells us how far we still have to go. Mark has made reference to to the whole testing process, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. I think we have moved a good deal forward from the days when school systems said, we aren't going to serve you because you're too disabled. And in 1989, the David D case, Timothy W. versus Rochester case, said all means all, and all children need to be served no matter how significant the disability. But that idea is still floating around. Because of all the No Child Left Behind testing, and there are certainly benefits that have accrued because of that, there has been a mania for assigning children to testing categories and moving children to alternate testing categories with alternate testing standards. And when that happens, there is an attempt to avoid accountability. And the message that gets sent when school systems don't have to be held accountable under the same standards is this underlying notion that they don't have to be accountable because children can't learn. And what Mark just referred to about changing accountability standards under No Child Left Behind and linking them to IEP progress is that message, that if you can hold school systems accountable for children with IEPs based on their IEP standards rather than the academic standards, it sends this message that school systems don't have to teach kids the same thing because they don't learn the same way, and because it's not fair to hold school systems accountable for them. So we have made a lot of progress over 35 years, but not enough. And I think at the outset of the IDEA and ESEA reauthorizations, it's appropriate to revisit some of the significant issues and look at current issues that we face and also some of the issues to think about as we move forward. I'm going to focus on least restrictive environment, on exit exams, and on discipline. I think we all know that one of the basic tenets of the IDEA is placement in the least restrictive environment. Children with disabilities have the right to be educated to the maximum extent appropriate with students without disabilities, to be placed in the schools they would attend if they didn't have disabilities, and to participate and to make progress in the general education curriculum. I will spare you all the law. I don't think you need to know that. Pro-inclusion advocates have criticized from the beginning the IDEA's requirement that there be a continuum of services ranging from general education placement to placement in private special education schools, residential treatment centers, and then, of course, home and hospital teaching. Anti-inclusion advocates, and the word inclusion doesn't actually appear in the law, but it's what the shorthand is for the LRE requirement. Anti-inclusion advocates criticize the focus of inclusion advocates on the general ed part of the continuum. Really, what we have are systemic barriers that push kids to both ends of the continuum. But we know that many students end up over-segregated into separate programs because of systemic barriers, such as the configuration of the service delivery system, such as the nature of the disability. We know that kids end up placed based on their race and ethnicity. There are all sorts of factors that are clearly illegal that go into placing children into the more restrictive end of the placement spectrum. And one of the things that comes up when reauthorization comes up is, ought there still to be a continuum? And I'm not going to answer that, but it's something that we throw out to spark some discussion. The whole issue of access and participation in the general education curriculum is one that bears some thinking about. When the law says be involved in and make progress in the general education curriculum, the whole question of what does it mean to be involved in? It's a really vague term. To make progress in throws us back to RALI. What's progress? How much progress? RALI required this sort of access, get your foot in the door, basic floor of opportunity. A lot of us, I think, thought when No Child Left Behind passed that basic floor was now higher. We were now up to the roof, maybe, but courts haven't really borne that out. So one of the things that we throw out for possible reauthorization issues for No Child Left Behind, or ESEA, as we all want to call it now, because No Child Left Behind are poisoned words, is what is the standard? What ought it to be? Is Rally dead? Is it still alive? Nobody really knows where things stand. So reauthorization is an opportunity to possibly revisit this. What does access to the general curriculum mean for students who are not in general education classrooms? Because under the IDEA, all students have a right to participate in the general ed curriculum. There is a requirement that curriculum be differentiated for kids. What does that really mean? And there's the whole issue of how teachers do that. So if Cindy is reading Black Beauty, she's reading Black Beauty. She may be listening to it on a CD. She may do a book report that's shorter than the book report other kids are doing. She may have other assistants in producing that report. But what about Samuel? Samuel may have something so, if he's even reading that book, Samuel may have something so watered down that all he gets is a story about a kid and a horse. But he may miss everything else about it. How is that curriculum provided to him? The reality is, for students like Samuel, his curriculum may be getting on a bus and going to McDonald's and ordering food. And who knew that a critical life skill was being able to order fast food? But that's the reality of what his program may look like. One of the other key issues that comes up in terms of accessing the general ed curriculum is supplementary aids and services and programmatic supports and modifications. Often, these are not provided effectively, or the same tiny little list of supplementary aids and services gets provided. How often, for any of you who do education work, do you see an IEP that has calculator and extra time on tests, and that's kind of all you see on an IEP? There is, in fact, a full range of supplementary aids and services. Programmatic supports and modifications are those things that can help the teachers and the school staff maintain a child in the general ed curriculum, but often they aren't provided, or they're provided ineffectively. A fundamental question: what if the quality of the general education program is really bad? What if you're trying to include a child into a program that in many cases is really bad, as is the case in high poverty areas? How do you address that? The long-term solution is litigation that's addressed at systemic reform. And as a veteran of a case that has lasted 26 years, it is really a long-term, really, really long-term solution. And what we found is you cannot fix special education without also addressing the underlying general education issues. But you get in it for the long haul. In the short term, you can use the programmatic modifications and supports and supplementary aids and services piece to get at improving the quality of services for more than just your client, because you can get teacher training, you can get other supports in place, behavior intervention services that help kids beyond the individual client you're representing. So as we talk about least restrictive environments, some issues to think about for reauthorization are this whole concept of the continuum of services. Should we toss it out the window? Is it too entrenched? Do we want to do something with it? And are there ways to use ESEA to strengthen or support the LRE requirement? Exit exams. There have been a number of lawsuits in many states addressing exit exams. And they all kind of have one theme in common, that kids have not had adequate access to the general curriculum and therefore are not prepared to take these exams. The teachers haven't known how to differentiate curriculum. There haven't been adequate supports and services in place. Kids aren't ready to take the exams. There is a huge need for professional development for teachers, and a lot of the professional development they get is not targeted to their needs. It may not be effective. It may not be efficient. But there also is a need for a sea change in what happens to teacher candidates in the higher ed institutions. I think a lot of us thought that when No Child Left Behind passed, we would see major changes in the teacher preparation system. You have special ed on one side, you have general ed on the other, never the twain shall meet, they don't talk to each other. I think we thought that that would change. And it's been frustrating that there has been as little change in that system as there has been. There are lots of discussions about dual certification, unitary certification. What should teachers know when they come out of college in terms of being able to meet the needs of kids who are in their classrooms? And there has not been nearly as much progress in that arena as there ought to have been. So I think we still face a lot of those questions, and a lot of teachers still walk into classrooms and have no idea what to do with the kids they're facing. So there still are significant changes needed. Some changes, good changes, were made in terms of, we heard about universal design for learning this morning. There were some significant changes in terms of UDL added to the Higher Ed Act when it was reauthorized, but there's still much, much more that needs to be done in terms of preparing teachers. There's still a lot of division between the functional life skills curriculum, the general ed curriculum. So if you have kids who move from functional life skills to an academic curriculum, they're not prepared. They're not going to be able to get on a diploma track. There's this illusory nature of the requirement that a student's assessment category be reviewed annually when the IEP is reviewed, because if you move a child off the diploma track and then try and move them back on to try to make up all those academic skills, becomes very, very difficult. So when diploma decisions get made, when a student's moved to the alternate assessment category under No Child Left Behind, and there are exit exams to prepare for, if the parent wants to then move their child 3 years later, 4 years later, back onto the diploma track, it will become extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, for that child to make up the academic piece if he or she has been deprived of the general education curriculum, as often happens when kids move to the functional life skills classes. The stakes are high. Students are penalized, and often what they're penalized for is inadequate teaching, lack of curriculum differentiation, the lack of good teacher prep. So, some issues to consider. One of my favorite quotes came from somebody in Texas when No Child Left Behind was enacted. He said, "You can weigh a cow every day, but it doesn't make the cow fatter." This idea that you can test kids, but it doesn't necessarily make the quality of education better. So what's the purpose of testing? You know, Mark said he's not a fan of testing, and I don't know that I am either, but that barn door's been open, and these tests are out there. But what's the purpose of them, and what do we really want to accomplish with them? You know, what's going to happen when ESEA is reauthorized? Is testing going to be an annual thing? We don't know. But I think we have to look at the relationship between testing and the quality of education. There's a move right now towards adopting national standards for math and reading. Those have been adopted. There are more national standards coming down the pike. Lots of states are talking about adopting international standards. Those are actually quite problematic for kids with disabilities. I think we all need to look at what our states are doing with these standards and how they affect kids with disabilities. There is also, in light of all this testing, talk in lots of states about differentiated diplomas. You know, that if you pass a test, you get one kind of diploma. If you don't pass a test, you get another kind of diploma. What's the impact of those on kids with disabilities? Can students go into the military? Can they go to higher ed? Can they get jobs? Do these diplomas mean the same thing? In lots of states, they don't. And kids get an alternate diploma and then find out that they can't go on to higher ed. They can't go into the military. So we have to be looking at those issues as well. Discipline is a huge issue for students with disabilities, and I would actually quibble with what Mark said about students not being excluded the way they were. No, students are not excluded from school in large numbers the way they were in 1975 when the statute was enacted. But there are large numbers of students who are excluded from school illegally because they are suspended or expelled, and we represent large numbers of those students. There are high disproportionate suspension rates of students with disabilities. And within that group, there is racial disproportionality. So why is that? It's because lots of those students do not have effective behavior intervention plans. There is a lack of proactive efforts to address behavior before suspension happens. There is, again, a lack of effective teacher preparation and professional development. There's a lack of effective use of supplementary aids and services, a lack of use of positive behavior supports and interventions. When school-wide positive behavior supports are used, they often, it's not implemented with fidelity. All three tiers of that program may not be being used. We know that high discipline rates can lead to increased segregation of students into separate programs. And if you think about it intuitively, segregating large numbers of kids with, say, emotional disabilities into one place where they all model each other's behavior doesn't really make a lot of sense. The 2004 amendments to the IDEA lessened the procedural protections. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the procedural issues, but it's something as we think about reauthorization, we may need to really spend some time trying to figure out how to win those protections back if we at all can. There's a lack of qualified school staff to conduct functional behavior assessments and implement behavior intervention plans. High use of restraint and seclusion with kids with disabilities in particular. There is federal legislation in the works. We all need to work on making sure that that passes. And there is an overall lack of understanding of the relationship between behavior and disabilities, and behavior disabilities and communication. So, for instance, Samuel, you have a student with disabilities who is suspended for hitting or kicking. What's the nature of, what's the relationship between that student's behavior and his effort to communicate when he's upset or angry? If you have a student with emotional or learning disabilities who's suspended for losing his temper and having an outburst in class when he's asked to read out loud or to sit quietly at his desk, or a student with autism who can't tolerate being touched, who tries to get up and leave and is restrained and then escalates when people grab him tighter and then he escalates more and then the police are called and, he gets hauled off to the emergency room. Those kinds of things, a lack of understanding of the relationship between communication and behavior. So what can we do? The early intervening services requirement of the IDEA can be helpful. Having districts intervene before behaviors escalate to the point of requiring disciplinary action. Implementing positive behavior supports with fidelity. Using positive behavior interventions and supports proactively. And advocating for not just consideration of positive interventions and supports, but requiring positive behavior interventions and supports when a team knows that a child has behavior issues. So those are some issues to consider. I think we also need to think about how to be looking at models of places that have effectively addressed disproportionality. When OCR disappears, as they do, when they have corrective actions in place and then they disappear after 3 years, how do we keep the reforms that have been made going so that things don't revert? 2 minutes. Okay, I'm almost done. We have less than 2 minutes. And then tying this all into least restrictive environment. When challenging behavior is addressed through supports and services, students can succeed academically. So all of these issues are intertwined, and you can't touch one without touching the others. I would say that as we look at reauthorization, we need to look at a couple of things. One is to make sure that we address the issue of making sure that we erase the zip code arbitrariness, because where kids live matters in terms of where they get services, and we need to instill the systemic improvements that guarantee that kids get services, effective services, no matter where they live. I think also that in every reauthorization, the disability community has been split. Groups have been battling each other, and these issues are too important for that. The mainstream civil rights organizations have not taken on education. There was a mention this morning of the ACLU in one of our groups. The NAACP, the ACLU, the Urban League, Leadership Conference, they need to be focused on our issues. We need to be working together. We also, all the disability groups, need to be working together. The school side groups are strong, and when we look at what happened in 2004, particularly with discipline, we cannot afford to lose more ground. So I throw out this call to action that we really need to work together, and we need to bring more groups in with us. Education is a civil right, and we absolutely need to join together. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. We're going to take questions. I would only say one thing. I got annoyed with the education system for blind students in America, and so I got a group together. My brother decided, he's a professor of education, he decided that he would take a year and find out what the education was all about and how to fix it, and we put him on as a staff member. And he came back and he said to our national convention, there's good education for blind children everywhere. I thought he was going to be dismembered before he left the room. All the parents sort of jumped up and down and said, not for my kid. And what he meant was there are people with good hearts everywhere and there is an effort to provide good education. But he overstated the case. I urge that we don't overstate the case, but I urge that we don't understate the case. So if you have a question, sing out. We'll.
Okay, I have a question. Matthew Dietz from Florida.
Matthew.
Thank you. This question involves exit examinations. In Florida, what they have is they have the FCATs, which is an exit examination, but a lot of kids in special ed get certificates of completion. And they're tracked to get the certificates of completion even from an early age. Has there been any systemic litigation, impact litigation, with the use of tracking people for not taking exit examinations?
So, go ahead.
I don't know of any litigation on that issue. I can say that in Maryland, we have a regulation that says that the decision about taking somebody off the diploma track cannot be made until the last year of high school, unless somebody is taking the alternate exam aligned to alternate standards, which, of course, under NCLB is only supposed to apply to the kids with the most significant cognitive impairments. So it's a bit of a protection for the larger group of kids to try to keep them from getting tracked the way that you've just described. So it's a way of dealing with it in a non-litigation way. I don't know of any cases that deal with that issue.
Lizzie, if I could just add one thing to that. There is some litigation.
I think we're recording, so if you could get on a mic there.
Is this live? Well, maybe I'm not close enough to it. There is some litigation that has established the idea of adequate notice before the exam. Maybe that can be extended to the idea that there's adequate preparation, but it would be an extension. The leading case that I'm aware of is the Brookhart case in Seventh Circuit from way back when. I think it's actually the middle 80s. So there may be some case law out there, but it's going to be a fight.
Jesse Hartle.
Hold on, Jess.
Thank you. The one thing I would just want to comment on is, as we move forward with educational reform, you mentioned that one of the accommodations in one of your scenarios was that of a reduced workload to remain as part of the accommodation to remain on a diploma track. One of the things we talked about this morning in the constitutional law workshop was that one of the ways that we as people with disabilities are going to be able to move forward is showing people the things we can do, and that we can do these things that people don't understand that we can. I would caution using a reduced workload as an accommodation, because what that says is that the only way this person with a disability is able to keep up with everybody else is to do less work. And that is not a way that I think we're going to move forward. So as we move forward with reforms, I would caution using that as an example of an accommodation to be used.
Well, let me respond to that. Because of the I part of IEP, the individualized part, my client has, as I said, learning disabilities and cerebral palsy, as well as vision impairment. And because of her cerebral palsy, it is her vision impairment is actually cortical visual impairment. So her vision fluctuates during the course of the day, and by the end of the day, she's very fatigued. So the reduced workload is that, let's say as an example, for math homework, there may be 20 problems. She may get 15 or 10 or whatever it is, because the important thing for her is to understand the concept, but not necessarily to do the same number of problems. Because her motor issues and the cortical visual impairment, and because pain issues from her disabilities make her get extraordinarily fatigued, that's the accommodation that she needs. And it really doesn't have to do with her ability. It has to do with her physical stamina. So in order for her to be able to do all of her homework and all of her courses, that is for her an appropriate accommodation. So it doesn't necessarily mean that for other people with disabilities, it's an appropriate accommodation, and it doesn't reflect on her cognitive ability, but it has a lot to do with her physical ability to get through a school day and do her homework.
Hi, I'm Susan Silverstein, and Susan, this is not my area of specialty, so I have a couple of observations that I make actually as a parent. But I think your connection to the general education and the way we educate our kids is really critical. And the issue about looking at that middle ground between inclusion, special settings, and so on is so important. When we were in a very rural school district, it turned out we had a very imaginative school district, and my non-special ed kid was actually exposed to a lot of really terrific opportunities because of their vision. They had classes of all different sizes. They had educational settings where maybe they had 15 kids with special education needs mixed in with kids with non-special education needs, and teachers who were cross-certified. And you never even knew which kid were the special education needs. My kid is a non-special ed kid. I felt got an exceptional education in that setting. And we were shocked to come to the Washington, D.C. area and find out that everything was all or nothing. And the second observation was that for my special education need kid, they were constantly using, sorry, I'm more anxious talking about this than about my cases, that they were constantly using LRE as a weapon against us. So when we had a kid who the slightest smell or a kid brushing against him could shut him down for the whole day, and we felt that he needed to work his, to be in a smaller setting, they were accusing us of wanting to segregate our child. So, you know, for them it was an excuse to not give him services. So that was just an observation. So I think we have to get away from that sort of polarization.
Comments?
You had a quick word on that. I mean, the culture of a given school is absolutely critical. I've talked with teachers in some places who say, yeah, so I've got 20% of my kids in my class with an IEP, big deal. They deal with the IEP, they don't treat the kids differently otherwise, it works just fine. In other places, it's a total culture of separate the kids out. And addressing that is, I think, very, very difficult, but as Leslie points out, that's crucial.
Other questions?
Daniel?
Yes, Leslie, you mentioned OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, and of course, at lunch we heard from Tom about everything that the Civil Rights Division is doing. I wondered if either one of you had any reports of new initiatives or new activities of any kind by the Office of Civil Rights, or could tell us of any sign of interest in addressing this more than has been addressed in the past by the Office of Civil Rights?
You know, there is the OCR of Department of Education just put out a press release on collecting data. And the data is helpful if, you know, it gets collected. What they'll do with the data, heaven only knows. But it is useful. They're going to start collecting data on seclusion and restraint, which nobody's ever effectively done before. As well as, I think corporal punishment was part of it, but I can't really recall all of the details of it. So it's a good sign, but I can't tell you more than that.
Beyond that, I'm not sure. I mean, individual folks there have expressed a tremendous willingness to do stuff, but I don't know of initiatives other than the data collection.
Other questions?
Chang.
Patty Chang.
I have two quick observations. I, too, am from Chicago, so one of them is directed mostly to Mr. Weber. How do we begin to address special ed systems, in particular resource rooms, that are deciding that as a general rule, all of the students that go through their system are going to graduate 1 or 2 years later? And I know this is happening because we had the coordinator speak to us last weekend, and she said it was happening. The second observation is related. I am increasingly being contacted by parents with issues related to testing that involve test questions that maybe cannot be answered easily by someone who is blind. In other words, the concept is tested in a way that requires vision. And I'm sure this can be applied to other disabilities too, but how do we deal with testing bias other than just removing those questions, which is not a fair answer because then we're subject to fewer questions and don't do as well on the test?
All I can say is that it's worse than that, I think. People may know this. Have anybody here taken the LSAT recently?
Recently,
very recently, because what they've done.
1,000 years.
No, like in the last 2 years, what they've done is they've tried to make it more and more like an IQ test, and one of those is by doing more of the things of which direction does this gear go type things, and so it's almost impossible to do the test without drawing out a diagram. So it's become worse than you would expect. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I would love to see somebody file an OCR complaint on that one. I think that the issue of the low expectations combined with you're not going to get there, or if you're going to get there late, is a pervasive problem, and one of the things that perhaps can be addressed by greater attention to least restrictive environment issues, but I think it's going to be a very difficult one. I do know that the people who are litigating and continue to litigate, again, for the last 20 years, the Corey H. case in Chicago, are looking for examples of the kind that you just mentioned. So I think that might be a way to possibly address the.
I hope that what you've said is accurate there, Mark, because I intend to quote you It is, of course, very important for lawyers to know which directions the gears go.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Other questions?
So the wheels of justice grind exceeding fine.
Yes. Both slow and fine, yes, right. Other questions?
May I make a comment?
Yeah, who's this?
This is Ed Moorman.
Yes, sir.
I spent a few months trying to teach in the Baltimore City schools, and I work here now because I failed, and I feel pretty bad about not having been able to do that. And in some ways, I feel like kids with single identifiable disabilities that do not affect their behavior, which is, say, blind kids, deaf kids, kids who have motor problems, can't walk or whatever, have an advantage over a lot of the other kids in a school district like Baltimore, where there's such a high poverty rate, where middle-class people move out of the city to, because the schools are better and the taxes are lower and outside the city. And it kind of it's overwhelming to me. I was a poorly prepared teacher, but very few teachers in the school I was at were able to control their classes at all. The IEPs were a joke. The special ed teacher was called in to help with discipline, spent very little time doing specific work with the kid. I had an illiterate 15-year-old in my eighth grade class who took a No Child Left Behind exam with a special ed teacher who not only read to him but also basically answered it for him. At this moment in American history when there's a real reaction against the government being able to do anything, and a city like Baltimore being in very severe financial shape, and the state of Maryland being in very severe financial shape, I'm not hopeful. And I don't know what the litigation strategies can do when the situation for kids with no disabilities who may have a behavior problem is as bad as it is. I'm sorry to say something that negative, but I don't feel hopeful.
I appreciate your comment. I was going to hold my comment for the end, but I'll offer it to you right now. I have two things. One of them is I expect students to succeed. I start with this proposition. I understand that there may be hardships and difficulties, but I expect them to succeed, and I begin there, and I expect us to figure out a way to help them do it. This is number one for me. And number two for me is, unless there's a demonstration that the disabilities prohibit it, we have to find ways to give everybody the chance to demonstrate their capacity for success. Part of the problem that we have encountered, it's the one that troubles me most, is that the teachers often start with the proposition that the students are going to fail. And if you start there, the students do fail. That means, from my point of view, that I want to find out a way to take over at least part of this educational system and run it in a way that demonstrates that a faith in the student can be justified by experience. I don't think the legal community can do it, but I think it can help. And I want us to begin with the proposition that the students will have success, and our job is to find out a way to make it possible for them to get at it. I'm sorry to have injected my opinion, but I thought I'd offer it anyway. Are there other questions? I want to say to you, Leslie,
Just jump in with one more question? Sorry. Yes. This is Allison DeFranco.
Allison?
Yeah, I have a question for, I guess, both of you generally. With a lot of studies coming out throughout various states with the idea that it's the top-down model that has been most effective in special education, the idea that administration, the principal, if the principal wants it to be an inclusive school that is going to have all kids together, similar to the model that was discussed where you have kids with and without disabilities in the classroom learning together, you know, how can that be advocated? Is that something, as well as also I think that parental knowledge and kind of parents having, you know, an idea of what their child's legal rights are is another really essential thing, and I think that they kind of go hand in hand. That I just wanted to see if you had any comments.
Mark or Leslie?
My experience, both personally and professionally, because I am the parent of a child with profound disabilities, is that who the principal is in the school really does make the difference. I think, and part of what I said before about zip code matters, the school really matters. Sometimes people come to me and they say, where should I move? You know, where are the best services? What district should I move to? And my answer always is, I can't really tell you that. I mean, you can make gross generalizations about districts within a state, but the reality is that who the principal is in a school makes all the difference. And, you know, principals leave. And so I can say, you know, I could say that this particular school is good or that particular school is good, but if the principal's not there the next year, it could be a totally different place. Administrators really set the tone for their schools. And so when we talk about teacher prep, I think we also are talking about administrator prep, except people don't go to school to become principals. And so that professional development is really key. And often you have administrators who don't have special education background, who don't really know what inclusion is or don't know about behavior intervention plans, or, you know, have this idea that you have to treat kids with disabilities the same way you treat kids without disabilities in discipline, and they don't understand. It's all this fairness thing. Well, if I discipline this kid, then why do I have to treat this kid differently? It's not fair. I don't get that. It's an attitudinal thing as much as it is a legal thing, and it's hard to get at attitudes in the law. So I think a piece, as much as we can do in the personnel development piece, you know, one of the things we lost in the last reauthorization was the comprehensive system of personnel development. So that's something to think about revisiting in the reauthorization process. How do you adequately train administrators? And when you look at systems of professional development, and it's discretionary, not mandatory, that people go to train to professional development, and they get evaluated. The evaluations look at, you know, were the donuts good and the temperature of the room okay? That's a problem. So I throw that out, that principals absolutely make a difference, and you have to look at the training they receive, the support they receive, the resources they receive. Can principals pick up the phone and get support from the administration? Because you also have well-intentioned principals who don't get the support they need, who can't pick up the phone and say, I've got this kid and I don't know what to do. I want to include this kid, but I don't have the supports. I don't have the services. I don't know what to do. And the administration that they report to has to be supportive as well. So trying to figure out how to build that in, whether it's through state regulations, state policies, the State Department of Ed resources, which is, I think, an important piece of it as well. But the whole system of personnel development is key.
And there are too few teachers, and there are too few administrators, and there are too few of the things that have to go into the hands of the students, and there isn't enough training, and there isn't anybody who knows what's going on, and even if you want to get some special education, then you can spend a lot of time and money getting more special education than you might have needed in order to teach, and you don't get any extra money for it. And this problem has to be solved anyway, and it doesn't matter how difficult it is. Our kids are too important not to do it. I understand the problem, I think. I keep hoping that I now understand it after these years of effort. We have to take part of this over. We have to run it. And we have to believe in it enough to make it happen for us. It seems to me that that's what we have to do, or at least that's where I think I'm going. Leslie, I appreciate your advice, and I appreciate yours, Mark, and I know that the prospect is better than it used to be and yet has certain dismal aspects, and I know that we're going to solve it regardless. I look forward to it later.